we're on our own. It's just regular people like us. It's moms and dads, and we don't have money behind us or anybody. It's really just us. We sell t-shirts so we can have picnics and stuff. Like, that's really, it's that, like, homemade. But it works.
It's grassroots, and I'm proud of that. Very proud. Yeah. This is grassroots.
It is.
So, and we're going to continue to win with the grassroots.
Hi, you're listening to We Are Reopen Box. In this series, we sit down with some of the key players in the reopen movement and discuss their experiences navigating the pandemic. Today, I'm joined by Representative Russ Diamond, who's currently serving his fourth term as representative from Pennsylvania's 102nd House District over in Lebanon County. He's also currently running for lieutenant governor and is widely known across the state as one of the most prominent fighters for medical freedom and a return to normal life. Welcome, Representative. Thanks for joining.
Sure thing, and you can call me Russ.
All right. Sounds good. So, Russ, first question right out of the gate. What's it been like working with a governor like Tom Wolf through all of this?
Well, we've actually not been able to work with him. I mean, he's kind of like an ivory tower guy, and he lets all these, you know, little minions and appointees around him make the decisions and do the communicating. So it's been a very long time since we've worked with Tom Wolf. Yeah, it's more like banging your head up against the wall, and it's very, very frustrating. But look, it's not something new in Pennsylvania. Actually, when Tom Wolf first got elected, he walked around the halls of the Capitol, and there was a couple times I actually was looking at my phone when I was walking down in the hall, and I actually, you know, almost bumped into the governor. But he became very aloof, you know, after his first or second year. But, you know, in Pennsylvania, we've had aloof governors for now almost a dozen years. And I think that's very problematic because the governor really needs to work with the legislative branch, not outside of it, because everything that we do has to go by him. So I think there needs to be a certain sense of working together. Now, look, granted, he's a Democrat and we're Republicans in the House and the Senate. But still, you know, even before that, when Tom Corbett was governor, there was a bit of an aloofness about him. And I think that speaks to the kind of personality of the person that you elect to be governor. I mean, Tom Corbett was a prosecutor. He was used to being the top guy in whatever office he was in, you know, given marching orders, and everybody followed. Tom Wolf was, you know, he kind of ran a family business and you give marching orders and people follow. In government, though, it doesn't work that way. It's you are co-equal with the legislature. So there's a lateral communication that has to happen. And I think if you have the wrong person in the governor's office who's used to this, you know, kind of top-down giving orders and, you know, everybody marches to the orders, that's not the right attitude to have in governance, because you do have two other co-equal branches of government.
It seems like a simple question of like leadership too. If you have a vision for where the people should go,
right,
that takes leadership to move folks in a certain direction.
Well, you have to rally people around.
Right.
And there's, you know, I guess one of the things that I have always looked for in leadership is, if you're a leader, are you still willing to get into the trench and start shoveling alongside the other people who you are allegedly leading? Because I think that always sets a good example for the people that you are leading. If you're willing to get your hands dirty just like they are, I think that says a lot about leadership.
So a huge point that would come out of all this that I feel like it sets Pennsylvania apart, it's something I'm very proud of, is the constitutional amendments, mm-hmm, where we essentially forced
yeah,
that, you know, equal branches of government. And I didn't even know this, but in getting ready for this interview with you, I went back to research, and the genesis of that constitutional amendment really goes all the way back to H.R. 836, which,
yes,
I did not know until
oh,
today.
Yeah, yeah.
You sponsored
yeah,
that.
Yeah, so the Pennsylvania's statutory law, the Emergency Services Management Code, it allows the General Assembly to do a concurrent resolution in order to terminate a governor's disaster emergency. It had never been done before. This law was written in 1978, and it was unanimously passed by the General Assembly. And I'm just not sure that, look, we had governors ever since then for 42 years, who used that emergency provision of the law responsibly during snowstorms, floods. Three Mile Island actually was one of the first tests of that law. And when the General Assembly enacted that law in 1978, you have to remember we had been through Hurricane Agnes 6 years before that. We were through more flooding in 1977, and then a 1977-78 energy crisis over the winter. So, and that's when they said, well, we need the way, I would imagine that this was a response to people complaining that the state couldn't respond fast enough to those emergencies. So the General Assembly passed this, and they passed it unanimously, and they built this provision in that I guess was a safeguard against a governor, a runaway governor. What they didn't think about was that a concurrent resolution, the Constitution, Article 3, Section 9, says any concurrent resolution has to be signed by the governor. So I don't think they did the math in their head. You know, now, the General Assembly could override the governor refusing to sign it, but I don't think they contemplated the exact situation we were in, where the General Assembly, the majority of the General Assembly, really wanted to end the disaster emergency because it became one-man rule. Right. It could be one-man rule, and exactly the opposite of what our system of government is supposed to be. And it took us going to this. I mean, let me back up. When I introduced House Bill 836, I was not aware of Article 3, Section 9 of the Constitution that says the governor had to approve, which is just a bizarre thing. It's like, okay, we the General Assembly, we disagree with the governor, but we have to get his permission to disagree with. It's kind of ridiculous. So I wasn't even aware of that provision. And it was brought to my attention by an attorney who does not work for the General Assembly. And I said, wait a minute, why did they write this law then? Because it just doesn't make sense. And I had talked to many, many people, including people who had 35, 40 years of experience working in Harrisburg. And they didn't connect these two dots between the statutory law that says we can override the governor, but the Constitution, which says, well, we need the governor's permission to do it. So I knew when we were doing the final passage of 836, I knew there would be a constitutional challenge to it. I knew it would go to court. And I knew we would probably lose because the Constitution always takes precedent. But we had to actually go through those motions in order to do it. So I had written the main constitutional amendment that we passed was a change of Article 3, Section 9 that said, except in disaster emergencies, you know, you have to get the governor to sign a concurrent. So I had written that constitutional amendment probably a month before we actually went to the Supreme Court, in anticipation that the Supreme Court would rule that the Constitution is supreme, and, you know, rightfully so.
Right.
But we had to go to court and actually let that play out in order to say, well, now we need to do a constitutional amendment. So I thought the only one we needed to change was Article 3, Section 9. And so I submitted that language. I just handed it over to the chief of staff for the Speaker of the House. I said, here's what we have to do to change the Constitution. He said, thanks. I appreciate the work you put in this. And it ended up into, I forget, it was Senate Bill 1160, I think. It was Kim Ward's, Senate Majority Leader Kim Ward's bill. My language was in there. But then they put in another provision in that kind of defined disasters, emergencies a little bit further, divided into, I think, four parts. Technological, natural, man-made, and industrial. I think those are the four categories. So they did something a little bit more complicated and added it in to make it two constitutional amendments rather than one. We passed them in House or in Senate Bill 1160 right at the end of the session. And conveniently, session ended. We came back and we did it again right at the beginning of the session. I mean, this was like record time for constitutional amendments. Usually they take 3 to 5 years, but I think that we were in such a quandary over this disaster emergency that the timing worked out perfectly, that we had it at the end of one session, the beginning of another session. But had I not introduced House Resolution 836 on day 11 of that disaster emergency, that was March 17th, 2020, Yeah.
I didn't even know it goes
Yeah,
back up
yeah. It was only 11 days after he declared it. And, oh, man, I got excoriated by the left because, you know, they, oh, you want people to die. And, you know, everybody was scared in the beginning of COVID. But it was day 11 that I introduced it. But had I not introduced it that early, I don't think we would have caught the momentum of the majority of the General Assembly in time to get a constitutional amendment passed by the end of the session. And remember, we were there all summer long fighting over this stuff. And it took that long to get the momentum, to get that going and get it finally passed and get it through the Supreme Court and then to formulate the language for the constitutional amendments. We passed them and that was the end of the session. But had I not introduced my House Resolution 836 on the day that I did, if I would have introduced it, waited a month or so, I don't know if we would have had time. And we might still be under a disaster emergency at this time. So it was all a kind of weird timing. It all worked out well. Well, it didn't work out well because it was sad that we had to do it. But we now have it straightened out that the General Assembly can, in fact, terminate a governor's disaster emergency. And I think, though, that the second constitutional amendment, which included the 21-day provision, you're familiar with that, is that in that no governor's disaster emergency can last longer than 21 days without legislative intervention. I think that may have... We may see someday that that complicates things a little further because, for instance, we had that bridge fall collapse in Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm. So the governor declared a state of a disaster emergency over that. Well, now every 21 days, you know, we got to extend that. So a governor can now keep a legislature on the hook by declaring smaller emergencies like that and requiring that. So,
and then it's politics because if you don't do it, you guys look bad.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, come on. So we may see some hitch down the road with that 21-day thing, and which wasn't my idea. I thought we should just be able to terminate at any time. But others, people thought differently. And it's like, well, that's the way we did it. We come to consensus in Harrisburg. But yeah, I mean, that's the story of House Resolution 836, how it's related to the constitutional amendments, and why now we have this system that we do where governor can declare a disaster emergency, but it can't last any longer than 21 days unless the General Assembly intervenes. So
it's so much more than a silver lining. It feels like it almost in some ways makes all the suffering, the how much everything sucked throughout spring, summer, fall of 2020. It makes it kind of a happy ending because when you look at what happened, especially with where we are now, people are just immediately going back to normal life. COVID's like in the rearview mirror, even for like the most rabid COVID enthusiasts. And when you go back and look like, well, where did everything turn? To me, in my mind, it turned on that primary day in 2021.
Yeah, it did.
We weren't even really expecting it. I don't know about you. I'm curious to hear what you were expecting, but it passed by a good chunk. It was like four or 5 points.
Yeah, I actually expected that. I didn't expect them to pass. I thought we were going to lose that vote. I was pleasantly surprised that we did win that vote. But it's also important to note that we were the only state in the entire nation that actually limited its governor's emergency powers due to, you know, through the COVID thing. No other state did anything like what we did. And I'm a little bit proud that it all started with day 11. You know, I introduced that resolution. Got tons of crap for it, and I just like stood tall and said, no, it's what we have to do, and I was right, and I kind of feel good about that because we did set ourselves apart from the other 49 states of the union and actually taking control, so I'm really proud of the people of Pennsylvania for that, proud of my colleagues in Harrisburg, some of whom I had to cajole and really, you know, get to go along with us, but we finally did it. I'll tell you that you're here in Montgomery County. You're in Bucks County.
Bucks.
Well, I just came out of Montgomery County, but I'll tell you an inside story. One of my colleagues back then was Marcy Topol, and she's from Montgomery County. And she was the caucus chairman. She runs the meetings when we get together and talk about bills on every session day. And it's not real a high-profile position, but I remember one day that she came to me, and we had so many co-sponsors, and we had all this pressure from rank-and-file legislators to move this. And leadership was hesitant. They were hesitant about actually moving this resolution. But one day, Marcy Topol came to me, and she said, Russ, I want to tell you, we had a leadership meeting, and I forget what Wolf had done, but it just set Marcy off. And Marcy told me that she spoke very sternly at the leadership meeting. We have to run Russ Diamond's bill. And that was the day that leadership actually turned the corner and we ran that bill. So I will credit someone who's kind of close by here in Bucks County, Marcy Topol, for being one of the catalysts for actually getting that thing across the finish line. So I don't think I've ever told that story before, but I credit her a lot with moving the rest of the leadership in the Pennsylvania House towards getting that bill across the finish line.
It was, I think, super important to go all the way back to H.R. 836 and realize that if you hadn't done that, if you hadn't pressed, then you don't set the table for the big constitutional amendment, which has changed everything now.
Yeah.
And I remembering back for myself and for people who are kind of like on the ground, the reopen crowds, right? There was this very pervasive feeling of like, well, what the hell are all these politicians doing? Like, do something, step in. You have to be able to stop this man. So it felt like even though it ultimately failed in the Supreme Court, it was a little bit of a moral victory that it's like, okay, we're all fighting back now. We're going to get on the same page.
Right. And we wouldn't have had, the impetus to actually do a constitutional amendment had we not had that Supreme Court battle that we lost, had we not fought from March till June to get that bill through the General Assembly, both the House and the Senate, and had I not introduced it on day 11 when everybody told me I was a kook, So it's one of the things that, you know, when people ask me, what's your proudest legislative accomplishment, I very simply put it, stopping Tom Wolf. It really was, it is my proudest legislative accomplishment. And we actually made history because we became the only state in the nation to limit our governor's emergency powers.
Now, in the shadow of all this, I feel like there's a few other constitutional amendments which have now been put into the hopper. Is this kind of a, you know, because it's so difficult, not just in Pennsylvania, but this just seems to be an issue in our forms of government, executive branches and legislative branches not wanting to work well together. Mm-hmm. Because we have that constitutional out where you guys can just pass it in concurrent sessions and then put it to the people, do you feel like this is going to be a new way that stuff is passed, just put it through the people?
I would hope that this does not become a regular occurrence, because amending our Constitution is a big deal. And I know that there's a lot of temptation to put policy things in the Constitution, and policy does not belong in the Constitution. The Constitution is simply the framework of government and the protection of our rights. And we should not put things that generally would otherwise be done with statutory authority. We shouldn't put those. There's a lot of things we shouldn't put in the Constitution. So I'm like back and forth about it. Now, typically, it's very difficult to get a constitutional amendment on the ballot because you do have to pass it in two consecutive sessions with an intervening election. And so, you know, times change, General Assemblies change. And that's why it is difficult. And that's why it's kind of rare. Now, through COVID, we were in common cause. And we were, look, this was that whole ending the disaster emergency. I think it was the one. A lot of people expected a lot of things out of the legislature during that time. Some people thought we could go arrest Tom Wolf. Well, we don't have that authority. Some people thought we could remove him from office, which we can through impeachment. But there's a certain process that happens, has to happen for that to happen. And it's a long and drawn out process. They wanted to end, and they wanted to end now. And, you know, that resolution and then the constitutional amendments were the things that were like the bright, shiny light at the end of the tunnel that we all saw. And it's like, we can get there. And I remember when we first passed or started talking about passing those constitutional amendments, people were complaining that would it take so long to get it on the ballot. And it was only till the next April.
Yeah.
But I mean, still,
you're talking about the end of one session, then right at the beginning of the other session, and then the primary is like 3 months later.
that's literally lightning speed for Congress. But everybody at the time said, oh my gosh, that's 8-9 months away. We can't wait that long. Our business is suffering. And I get it. I mean, I wanted to get it on the ballot right away. And you could do that with an emergency amendment, but then you need 2/3 of the legislature and only pass it in one session, but you need two-thirds of the legislature, which is the whole reason we did the Constitution to begin with, because we couldn't get two-thirds of the legislature to override Tom Wolf. It's a very fascinating time in Pennsylvania history.
So one potential weapon to try to stop him, which I've talked about regularly but consistently by literally everybody on every side that I've ever brought this up, where they say, no, that's not reasonable, is you could have weaponized the budget and just refused to give him a budget. Was that ever a possibility, like in anybody's eyes?
I don't think it's unreasonable. I think it is a very reasonable thing to do because it's one of the only things that we actually control is the purse strings.
Right.
And I, you know, I wanted to. The problem is that politically that doesn't play out well because every school district depends on the state budget.
Hmm.
Every nonprofit that does good things for good people depends on the state budget. So it's very politically untenable for us to say, but we're just not passing a budget. And then on the other side of it is that this particular governor doesn't pay much attention to the budget figures we give him to begin with. I mean, he spent, on the human services side, he spends about $1 billion more dollars than we actually appropriate every year. And that just leaves us, and there's not a whole lot we can do about it because he can, he has the power to shuffle money between this fund and that fund, and he just does it. I'm not sure how we can get that under control, except by electing a Republican governor and lieutenant governor.
There you go. Yeah. So how did this all start for you? I mean, obviously, I mentioned in the lead-in that to a lot of people, like our group, Reopen Groups, you became a lightning rod, a hero for always going out there, giving stump speeches, speaking to it. At a time when I feel like a lot of representatives and senators were trying to maybe just see how it plays out, take their time. Mm-hmm. On the Republican side, I mean, so how did this lieutenant governor thing come together for you?
Well, actually, I will go back about a year and a half here to January of 2021. Our state senator, Dave Arnold, he actually passed away. He had brain cancer and he passed away. But he was a member of the Republican State Committee. And I had asked my county to appoint me to fill out his term because I wanted, because of what we had been through with Tom Wolf through the COVID thing, I wanted to have a hand in who our next governor is going to be. So I got on Republican State Committee knowing that, you know, they do the endorsement process and they vet all the candidates. I wanted to have a hand in that. And it got to be about Christmas last year, which was about a year into my term on State Committee. And I realized, I'm looking around, it's like, well, who's running for lieutenant governor? And I saw a couple names, a couple familiar names, but nobody there that had actually materially participated in what happened through COVID. And I thought it was important to have someone on our eventual ticket, which will, you know, come to pass after the primary, where the governor and lieutenant governor are tied together on one ticket. I thought we needed to have somebody on that ticket who actually materially participated in all the things that happened during COVID that folks could identify with, rather than some people who didn't have the experience of that. And I also, you know, I looked to that when I was, when we were considering U.S. Senate candidates as well. I'm like, well, who was here in Pennsylvania? I mean, you look around at that field of Senate candidates, there are some people who weren't anywhere close to Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
And I thought it was important that all of our statewide candidates at least had some experience in Pennsylvania while Pennsylvanians were suffering the most in either, you know, they had a business that was shut down, or maybe they were a legislator who worked through it and understood the dynamics of that fight that we just talked about with the constitutional amendments and stuff, or, you know, was actually here in Pennsylvania while the people were suffering. Because if you weren't here in Pennsylvania while the people were suffering, and maybe your business was suffering too, I don't think you can understand what Pennsylvania needs for the next 4 years. I mean, we need to get out of that malaise that we were in. I mean, it was a very frustrating time in Pennsylvania. And, you know, we had people who would call our office in tears because they couldn't get their unemployment. I mean, we didn't even talk about the unemployment fiasco that was. Oh, my gosh. I still have people calling my office who are still trying to get things straightened out from during COVID because of the unemployment and absolute mess that was created. And I lay that right at the governor's feet. I mean, because that's his baby. And in the middle of all that, they tried to upgrade the computer system, which made it was just a nightmare. And it was a nightmare for us in our district office, because generally when people have unemployment problems, they call us and we can make a phone call, and you know, within 2 or 3 days we can straighten it out. Well, people were going months, and now we're at the year's point and they didn't have their unemployment situation straightened out. I mean, it's still a mess. It really is a mess. It's not as nearly as bad as it was, but that's why and it was around Christmas time where I decided, you know, I think I'm going to throw my hat in the ring for lieutenant governor, because I don't see anybody right now at that point in time who had actually had any kind of either experience with their business being shutting down or legislative experience, like fighting with the governor and that sort of thing. And I thought that was important to have on our statewide ticket in all three of the races.
And yeah. You spoke in there too, the fact that, so on the primary, there's like separate parts of the ticket, yeah, for lieutenant governor and governor. And then after the primary, they come together, yeah, on a combined ticket. What does that look like for you? I mean, I know that there's a couple folks like in either race who kind of have their preferred candidate to pair with or, yeah, whatever, but
For me, look, yeah, I mean, this is like an arranged marriage where the voters are the matchmaker. You run separately in the primary, and then after the primary, you're inexplicably intertwined, and you can't separate yourself from, you know, the governor candidate from the lieutenant governor candidate. And I always thought that it was a little bit foolish for people to say, well, here's my running mate. It's like, well, you don't get to say that. This is not like the president who gets nominated and then says, well, my vice president is Mike Pence. You don't get to pick. The voters pick. So I've never understood why somebody would say, well, here's my running mate for the fall. It's like, well, you're putting the cart before the horse. So I have always said, you know, look, there's 9 lieutenant governor candidates and there's 9 governor candidates. And my thing is, look, I'm willing to work with anybody who's willing to work with me. And I get asked all the time, well, what? And I just got asked tonight at an event I was at, what candidate do you prefer to work with? And I'm just like, I prefer to work with the one who can best beat Josh Shapiro, because that's our goal this year as Republicans, is beat Josh Shapiro. So whichever one the people think can beat Josh Shapiro, that's the one I want to work with.
There it is.
Yeah.
It's going to be a pretty big year.
It is going to be a big year. You know, and, you know, as we're recording this, I think we're 10 days away from the primary. Yeah, and, you know, it should be an exciting time. It's been a long 5 months or 4 months since I decided to throw my hat in this ring. I've been all over the state. I think I've been to every county. And, you know, Pennsylvania is a big state. And this is not my first rodeo with statewide campaigns. This is like my 4th statewide campaign of one sort or another. It's not always for my own candidacy. But it's the 4th time I've spent months traveling around the state. And I think what a lot of people don't appreciate is how diverse our state really is. You know, for instance, where I'm at in Lebanon County, we have a much different attitude than, you know, some folks down here in Bucks County. And even here in Bucks County, you have got a much different attitude up in the northern part of Bucks County than you do down in the Ben Salem, you know. So, but it's that kind of thing all over the state. I think you could really divide the state up into 7 distinct kind of regions that all have their own distinct traditions, cultures, that sort of thing. And it's really nice to see the diversity of Pennsylvania. And as a statewide candidate, you have to really appreciate that and understand that before you can understand the dynamic that it takes to actually run a statewide campaign. You have to understand the diversity of our state and that we're basically 7 different states, you know?
Yeah. There's something in there that I, hopefully I'm not like pulling you into unnecessary drama here, but we are having some issues here in Bucks County when it comes to the idea that you alluded to when you wanted to get on state committee to have a hand in endorsements and what would happen with that. And interestingly, this year, I believe the state GOP decided they're just not going to endorse for any races. We're just going to stay out of it, let the people decide. Well, Bucks is one of these counties where they did endorse, and just because of the way it played out, a lot of people think that there was some shadiness.
Mm-hmm.
What's your feeling just in general on, I feel like there's right now kind of a wave in conservatism of like, let the people decide, just let it go, you know, open primaries type of thing.
Yeah.
What's your thought on all that?
Well, there's always that back and forth between should the party endorse before a primary? And look, I'll admit to you before, you know, I'm not just a state committee member. I'm also a member of my local county, the Lebanon County GOP, the Republican Committee in Lebanon County. And I've been on that committee for, I'm thinking, a dozen years now. And so I go back and forth on the endorsement issue. Look, I think that generally speaking, when you have an open seat, like the governorship is this year, like the U.S. Senate seat is this year, I think you should defer to the will of the voters. That said, part of the job of a Republican committee member is to potentially weed out people who aren't good Republicans, you know, because maybe there are some people who are, they're more like Democrats. And it's like, well, and if you got like, let's say you got a David Duke running in the Republican primary, I would think you would want your state committee or your county committee to step in and say, this is not acceptable and is contrary to Republican values. I think you would want to do that. The other drawback of staying out of the races is, look, we have 9 candidates for lieutenant governor, 9 candidates for governor. And that means, mathematically speaking, you could have a winner who only gets 12% of the vote. And you can have 88% of your electorate dissatisfied with the nominee. I would have liked to seen these fields be narrowed down, at least like cut in half. I mean, I think 4 candidates, 5 candidates might be doable, but 9 candidates is a lot. It really is. And at one time, I think the governor's race had 13 candidates in it. Now, there was some natural weeding out there of people who just, they couldn't get on the ballot or what have you. But 9 candidates is a lot, and it's a lot for voters to take in. How do you learn about 18 different candidates for governor and lieutenant governor? And so that makes it our work as candidates then. It's like, this is why I don't go home anymore, and why my yeah. why my
You're
wife,
out here now.
You know, my wife, she is not all that happy that with all the traveling that I have to do. But I keep telling her, I say, look, this is what I have to do. And I always invite her to come along, but she doesn't like political things that much, you know. So I just, you know, try to encourage her to come along, because sometimes these trips are like, you know, 5 hours long one way. And I need somebody to talk to as well, you know, because it's lonely for me listening to the same CD over and over again and, you know, just going through my mind. And I mean, I take a lot of phone calls while I'm driving. Look, even in a normal year, if you were even an endorsed candidate and like state committee is picking up a lot of the work for you, you know, the back end work, it's still a grueling schedule to get all the way across the state in a few short months. But it's what you have to do. And I've been willing to do it. And I won't admit that I'm tired, but May 17th, I'll be kind of happy that I can stay home, cut my grass, you know, do the things that normal guys do at home and, you know, clean up the yard, that sort of thing. I'll be grateful for that. I'm hoping the grass doesn't get too high before the next 10 days, although it rained all day today. And I can almost literally see the grass growing at home. And it's like, okay, well, I better get that cut. Hopefully I'll get a day before it gets too long to get cut. But
it's starting now, all the growth.
Yeah.
Well, you won very handily. We did like a little silly straw poll in our group. Mm-hmm. 500-600 people, something like that, voted, and you were the clear-cut winner for lieutenant governor in that straw poll. So even though you're tired, you got a lot of Reopen Bucks folks rooting
for you. I really do appreciate that. And that really goes to what my reasoning was for getting in this race, because I think that people recognized that I was out there and I was talking to somebody at the meeting I was at earlier tonight. Linda, who ran the meeting. She first heard me speak at the very first reopen out rally in front of the Capitol. I believe it was April 20th, 2020. And I remember that rally distinctly because I remember it distinctly because I did kind of like a selfie video, like panning around and doing the crowd. And I was 40 feet away from everybody. I mean, there was nobody near me, 40 feet. And I got crap because I wasn't wearing a mask. I think back to that, it just amazes me. It's like, why would anybody expect me to have a mask on when I'm 40 feet away from everybody outside? It's ridiculous. But
here's why, though. Here's why. I mean, when I walk into the booth in a couple of weeks, I'm voting for you. This whole situation with COVID is a question of leadership. For you to introduce that bill, what you said, 11 days into his declaration, leadership requires vision. And so many people, even people who are running, people who kind of just jump on the bandwagon and want to use it for their own purposes, they're not leading. You know, to lead, you have to take some bullets. You got to charge.
Well, you got to take some chances. And you got to be able to, how do I best want to describe it? Sometimes you actually have to start the parade, not just jump into one. And starting a parade means you're going to be all alone out there. And you're going to take some hits. And I did. Look, during COVID, I took some serious hits because I was the first one to do that. I was the first one to stand up against mask mandates. I was the first one to say, it's this closing of schools and all the social distancing, it's crazy. And it's going to cause psychological and academic problems with our kids. I was the first one to say that. I was the first one to even suggest that we need to do legislation to protect people from vaccine mandates before there was even a vaccine for COVID-19. So I was first out of the box on all of those things. And for every one of those things, I got roundly criticized by the woke crowd and the left, you know, saying, oh, you're crazy, you're radical, you don't care about people, you want people to die. But here's the thing, I was right about all those things. And it was my common sense that made me know that I was right about those things. It wasn't my fear of political retribution. And although there was that nagging feeling in the back of my head, because that was an election year. And a friend of mine, about a month before that general election, because I had an opponent, he said, What share of the vote do you think you'll get? Now, I live in a heavily Republican district, so I was pretty fairly sure I would win. But I said, well, you know what? I've done a lot of risky things this year. I've gone against the grain, and you know, I've been criticized a lot for being out front, you know, fighting against the COVID mandates and all that stuff. I said, I think I'm going to get 62% of the vote, where generally I would get like 65% in my district, because it's a heavy Republican district. Well, the election came around, and I ended up getting over 70% of the vote. So I went back to my friend then. I said, boy, I should have taken some more risks. I left a little bit on the table there, you know what I mean? But, you do. You have to take risks. I mean, and you have to have there's two different kinds of vision. There's the vision where you're looking at things from a 100,000-foot view level. You know, I'm kind of like that. I look at big picture stuff, and I don't like getting caught up in the details of the weeds. I just have these big ideas that I think America should be and Pennsylvania should be. Mm. And then there's another kind of vision where it's like, well, here we are at this crossroads, and we have to do something big. And we're there on the vaccine mandates now. We're there at a crossroads that our founding, similar to what our founding fathers were at, because my legislative fight against vaccine mandates is now, I've elevated that to the constitutional level, where I think we need to have medical freedom as a fundamental individual right that is protected by the Constitution. And it should be in Article 1 of our Constitution. And I see that that's kind of a different kind of vision, because it's the kind of vision our founders had when they wrote enshrined our freedom of speech, our right to bear arms, our right to a jury trial, our right to not have to quarter troops in our home. They didn't do that in some speculative way. thinking that those things might happen in the future. They lived through that crap. They lived through a time when your right to free speech, your freedom to worship, your right to a jury trial weren't guaranteed. And they knew how bad it was. And we're at the same point, I think, on vaccines. Since 1986, Big Pharma has had kind of free reign to do whatever vaccine they want, and then government follows through and mandates that vaccine. And nobody's really given it a second thought until now. The experience we've seen with the COVID-19 vaccine shows us that now we do actually need to protect the right for an individual to make that choice on their own, not be forced by anyone, especially not by government, but also not by corporations, which now sometimes wield more power than governments. So we need to not just protect the people from government, but we also need, after the fact, to protect them from discrimination from entities like corporations and nonprofits who are only acting as corporations and nonprofits with some sort of government grant of privilege, because you can't be a corporation unless the government says you can. So in some respects, you're a state actor then. So it's not like we're ruling the private sector, because if you're a corporation, you're only doing that with permission from the government to operate that way. So in some respects, I believe we have the right to regulate you then and what you can and can't do. Just like we tell people you can't discriminate against anybody based on their race or their gender. Well, I don't think you should be able to discriminate on somebody based on their personal medical decisions that they've made for themselves. And we need to protect that in our Constitution. And that's what House Bill 2013 is all about. And that's like my big focus right now. We just got, I think, our 56th co-sponsor. So I've been talking to our majority leader as to, you know, when can we bring this up for a vote on the House floor? It's a constitutional amendment. Again, we talked about that before. So,
big deal. It's so timely, because this was early, just a couple days ago. All of a sudden, nobody's talking about this. You don't know about this in the news. Probably a lot of listeners of this episode don't know about this. The Johnson & Johnson vaccine has been pulled completely because of blood clots. And that was the one that, like, out here, a lot of nurses were forced to take. The teachers out here.
That was the one-shot deal, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's like, yeah, now they're pulling it. And for how long have people said, well, you got to get this thing? Come on. I mean, we have crossed the Rubicon. And we're at the point our founders were at when they said, we need to protect the right to bear arms. And, you know, after Concord and Lexington, they said, yeah, we need to protect that. And the right to free speech. And we need the right to medical freedom. And because we've crossed the Rubicon on that issue. And it's just time to draw a line in the sand. So
definitely be keeping an eye on that again. Yeah. Maybe another silver lining to look forward to come out of all this.
We hope so. Yeah.
Changes,
yeah.
And we can do great big things. Yeah. But yeah, we in the near future have this big election. Be keeping an eye on it.
Yep.
I'm personally rooting for you. I know the group is because of our straw poll.
I mean, that's great to hear. I'm glad to hear that I have some support out there. It's you know, I've been through the COVID stuff. I've got so much negativity thrown at me, not just from Pennsylvania, but you know, the left has taken it to international levels where I got attacked from places in the world I didn't even hear of before, you know?
Well, you threatened the whole system. That's part of
the problem. Yeah. I contradicted the whatever the narrative was. I mean, the narrative was just foolishness. Mm. And I contradicted it and got a lot of scorn for it. So it's always good to hear when people say, we support you. Yep. It's always nice to hear positive reinforcement.
And I got to believe the timing for everything you did, the persona you've built for yourself, it's got to be good, because now that life kind of goes back to normal, you got a lot of people who didn't really care very much who are suddenly starting to realize, like, oh, yeah, all that stuff those people were saying all that time, they were right.
Yeah, they were right. And, I mean, the other good thing, this is another silver lining that came out of COVID, was that and this really is a silver lining. Parents are paying attention to what's going on in our schools now. Whereas we were just, you know, we were okay before, just sending our kids off to school for 7-8 hours a day and, you know, trusting that they were learning what they were supposed to be learning and that everything was kosher. And now we're finding out, well, that might not be the truth. And parents are paying attention. They're taking over their school boards. And I hope they keep paying attention and they don't go back to sleep, because when we go back to sleep, that's when things go awry. So there are a couple good things that came out of COVID. Not many, but there are a couple good things, and that's one of them, is the parents are now really in tune with what may or may not be going down in our schools.
And the school pendulum feels like it's swinging so far that now we're having real conversations starting to pop up around about a school choice type of environment. Do you, as a sitting legislature and you're running for lieutenant governor, do you see that as something that's feasible in Pennsylvania's future?
I do see, if we have a Republican governor, a Republican lieutenant governor, and a Republican legislature, I do see a movement back towards school choice, especially after we've been through COVID. Now, we haven't had a real school choice movement since, I believe, when Tom Ridge ran for governor. He kind of ran on that. We're going to do vouchers, you know, where you can just send a kid to school wherever you want. And I think we can, I think that's doable in Pennsylvania. I think that we can't give short shrift to our public schools, either, because we have an obligation, to have a public education system in Pennsylvania. So I don't think our public schools are going to fight against competition per se, unless the playing field is not level and it's stacked against them. I think, you know, whatever we do as far as creating competition, playing field's got to be level, right? You know, and we can't give our public school system short shrift either. So that's one of the big concerns of the public school systems now, is how much money is being drained from them, from kids who are going to charter schools, and that sort of, and they don't think that the playing field is level, and that's what they're working toward now. And I'm with them on that. It's like, well, let's not stack the deck against them. Let's not, you know, we don't need to stack the deck for or against anybody. Let's just make it a level playing field where the money, and this is the answer. And we're trying to look at this at the post-secondary level too, where let's start, instead of funding institutions and buildings, let's start funding students and empowering parents. Because it will be parental choice that would determine that the best educational opportunities succeed,
right?
And they win out. You know,
force natural selection.
Yeah, if you have a poorly run program, you're just not going to have any students, and you won't be able to afford to remain intact.
We had 10 minutes down the street here a private school, Faith Christian Academy. Mm-hmm. That was, through all of 2020, 2021, completely normal. No distancing, no masks, no nothing. They just went to school like normal. And I can't help but feel like when a school can pull that off, and they did, despite all the rules and the mandates and all this stuff, they made it happen. You know, all you need is a few of those in a system where there's choice, and all the others would have had to do the same.
Yeah.
Because everybody would have wanted that.
Exactly, exactly. I mean, you know, it's a market-based idea, and...
Exactly.
I mean, look. Education is a core role for government in Pennsylvania, according to our Constitution. Article 3, Section 14 and 15 demands that we in the General Assembly take responsibility for that. But I don't. It doesn't say that we can't do a competitive system. It doesn't stipulate how we have to fund it. It just says that, you know, we've got to do it. So there's a lot of room to wiggle around in there and figure out a system that works best and gives every child a shot at a world-class education. And I think that's what every parent wants. Every parent wants to not be stuck sending their kid to perhaps unsatisfactory educational opportunities simply because they're in a certain zip code. You know, I'm not pointing out any particular schools, but look, some schools in Pennsylvania are better than other schools. And it's, for some reason, we base it on the zip code. It just shouldn't be that way. You know, the parents should be able to use whatever money we're appropriating for their particular child, figure out what works out. And look, for most people, it's going to be public school system. For most people, it's going to be the public school system. Because sending a kid to private school, it's a bit of an extra hurdle. You know, you've got transportation issues, you've got, you know, whatever other issues. But we create a competitive system where everybody's playing by the same rules and has the same metrics that they have to follow. I think you're going to have you're going to create a system where very quickly educational rock stars will shine, and they will attract kids, and families will want their kids to go there, and competition makes everybody better.
That's a great way to put it.
Yeah.
And it's good that you even called out some of the challenges. I mean, the nuance associated with these issues is that's the important star. That's where all the magic happens, I feel like,
yeah,
with this stuff. So
None of this stuff happens in a vacuum. Everything is tied together, you know, because our education system is tied to our tax structure, which is tied to our labor laws, which is tied to, you know, everything in Pennsylvania is like a little cog in a big machine, and it's connected to a bunch of different cogs, and there's a lot of good ideas that sound really good in a vacuum. But once you then start taking into account all the other cogs that are involved in that, then you go, oh, well, maybe we can't do it that way. You know what I mean? So you have to have a broad understanding of all these issues. And that's kind of like the magic of being in the legislature, is that you get exposed to everything, how everything is just connected, you know, and it's all supposed to function as one big well-oiled machine, which it often doesn't, but that's the goal, you know, and understanding all the pieces and all the gears and all the wheels and all the cogs that are involved in what makes governance work. It's absolutely fascinating to me.
So where can folks go to learn more about, I mean, your positions on all these different things that you want to do, how it all works together, the cogs you're talking about, you know, if folks want to either jump in and learn more about you or even help in this last lap.
They can go to my website, which is www.russdiamond.vote, not .com, not .net, not .org, but russdiamond.vote. They can learn all about my candidacy for lieutenant governor. If they want to help out, send a contribution, order a yard sign to put in their yard here over the last few days, they can do that there. They can find me on Facebook at Friends of Russ Diamond. They can also follow my personal page. I'm maxed out on friends. I got inundated with friends over the last week or so, friend requests. So I'm maxed out on friends, but a lot of people follow me. And it's just Russ Diamond on Facebook. I'm over on Twitter at Russ Diamond, although I don't use Twitter that much. Although I will if Elon Musk holds up with his promise, you know. And I'm on Getter. I'm on Parler. I'm on Jiminy Cricket. I'm on Gab.
There's so many.
Yeah. But just do a search for Russ Diamond on all those alternative platforms. You'll find me there. But I'm really happy with, folks seem to be happy with the platform I've put out. So if you want to learn more about it, that's where to go. Russ Diamond .vote, and got some videos on there. In fact, a music video. I did a song a few months ago and got some footage of some rallies I was at and included it. And we have some fun with the videos over there sometimes.
Well, very good. Well, rooting for you the rest of the way. Good luck. And
thank you.
We'll talk to you on the other side of this.
All right, Josh. Thanks for coming on. Thank you so much.